Coming to you live from the shores of beautiful Lake Washington, in Kirkland, Washington, the home of the original Costco, just a hop, skip, and a 10-gallon drum of Yoshida's teriyaki sauce from the place where you buy pallets and pallets of food. It's Jim Valley, back from a week in Las Vegas. It's Saturday Morning Wrestling, PWTorchLiveCast.com, and I am so happy to be with you today. Unlike all of those other weeks where I just fake it. Not really. I'm very excited to be here today. I had a great, great, great week. What fun. Just wrapped up the Cauliflower Alley Club in Las Vegas at the Gold Coast Hotel and Casino. And, you know, we talked about it on the show. We've had Brian Blair on talking about it. And I know that it's exposed some of you to the Cauliflower Alley Club. And let me tell you, I cannot recommend it enough, and we'll get into that and talk about that and all, just all the great things that happened this past week and why you should go. And really, you should go because, one, you don't know how long some of these legends are going to be with us, and take the time to get to talk to them and interact with them and learn about the past and just appreciate some of your childhood memories or even some things that contributed to your childhood memories that you may not even know about. But not only that, I can't stress this enough, too. It's super affordable. You know, the rate at the Gold Coast is like $45, something like that. And it's totally clean, and it's very well appointed for the price point. I mean, I've stayed at worse, and I've paid more for a lot worse. I mean, it's not the hippest place in the world. It's not Planet Hollywood or Vidara or The Wynn. But for what you get, it's a hell of a deal. And not only that, but you know, if you go to WWE Access, I know some people, you know, go to that and they complain that they spend all day in line, you know, waiting for autographs. And that's, you know, that's fine. I mean, they're big, major, real, you know, active stars right now that, you know, people want to meet. And that's cool. But if you go to the Cauliflower Alley, it is so relaxed and so chill. You know, you can just walk up to people and get a picture. You know, you can walk up to Sergeant Slaughter and say, you know, excuse me, you know, Sergeant Slaughter, may I get a picture with you? You can take a picture and have a few words with him. And, you know, depending on what he's doing, you know, you may be able to have a conversation depending on the situation. It's just so pleasant. You know, and there are a few people there who were selling autographs, and that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not criticizing it, but I'm just not in the place in life where I totally mark out for stuff like that, where I'm going to pay for autographs or pay for pictures. That's just not me. I mean, a lot of people did, and a lot of people had a great experience, but I'm just not my thing. So I didn't pay for any autographs. Like, I think, like, Mean Gene was charging, and I think Jerry Lawler was charging, which is, again, their prerogative. I think the High Flyers were charging. Again, you know, make some money. Why not? Nothing wrong with that at all. Just not really my thing. But, I mean, you could just go and just have a great time, and there's a bunch of other wrestling fans and wrestlers, and just so much fun. They call it the Circle of Friendship, and you can see why. And the other thing about the Cauliflower Alley Club is that, you know, I mean, it goes way back to Mike Mazurki in the 60s and the late 70s, or the early 70s, and, you know, a different era, and a lot of that generation, unfortunately, is leaving us, and there's a few around. I mean, I was so lucky to go, and, you know, Dick Beyer is still there. And obviously, if you've been following me on Twitter at Jim Valley, you saw my interaction with Lance Russell, who just turned 90 years old. And coming up in just a little bit, we'll play the exclusive interview with Lance Russell. And it's I'm pretty proud of it. I'm very happy with the way it went. And I will say this. One of the things that I try to do on this show is try to do things a little differently, and not because I'm trying to get attention or I want to stand out or anything like that, but we live in a world, the online connected, interconnected world, where there's a lot of different interviews, and you can find them on YouTube, and you can find them online, and you can download them, and everybody's got a podcast, and there's so much content out there that I don't want to repeat a lot of the same stories, because what's the point? You've already heard that. So I want to let you know ahead of time that we don't talk about Andy Kaufman. And I loved Andy Kaufman, and I saw a lot of that stuff. I just happened to be watching David Letterman that night live when it happened, when Jerry Lawler slapped Andy Kaufman. I saw that as it happened as a little kid because I was very unsupervised and my parents didn't love me, so I did whatever I wanted. And look how it turned out. Ugh, geez, they should have supervised me. But that's a story for another time. But so we didn't talk about that. And the reason is because that interview is everywhere. I mean, any interview you can download right now with Lance Russell is going to talk about that. So I tried to go in some different directions and talk about some things that are not out there. And I think we covered some really good ground for the amount of time I had and the situation. So there's some new stuff we're going to talk about with Lance Russell. And it's so hard to encapsulate such an amazing career in just, you know, about 35 minutes or so. But we touched on a lot of different things, and I'm really happy with it, and I think you'll enjoy it too. He even surprised me with some things that he chose to talk about, which I didn't expect. But we had a great time with that. And also, if time permitting, I also did an interview with the grappler and the Cuban assassin, Fidel Sierra. And you may know him. He wrestled in the Northwest. He wrestled in Florida. He was a tag team. You may remember the Cuban connection on Nitro from Ricky Santana. And he's a guy who you may not know a lot about, but he traveled the roads and did a lot of things. And he's got some great stories. And that's what this show is about with Saturday Morning Wrestling. I'm never going to get the big, big stars, and that's cool. And I shouldn't. That should go to Wade Keller on Thursdays, because Thursday is the main event. But we're going to get some great stories, and I promise you that even if you haven't heard of some of the people or you have limited knowledge of some of these people, you're going to hear great stories that you can relate to and you're going to love, and it's just going to deepen your appreciation for this crazy, wacky world of pro wrestling. So I do have that interview in the can. If we have time, depending on your phone calls, if you want to talk about Cauliflower Alley, you can call up at 646-721-9828 today, 646-721-9828. You can also tweet me at Jim Valley. Had a lot of interaction on the Twitter this week, and gosh, I really appreciate it. I mean, geez, my analytics were huge this week. I got retweeted by Jerry Lawler and Mean Gene Okerlund and a ton of people. Got all kinds of great exposure and new followers and new people to interact with, which I love. So if you haven't done that, be sure to do that. Matter of fact, if you go to my Twitter right now, you can see I'm all ready for the show. I'm wearing my Intelligent Sensational Destroyer mask and my awesome Lance Russell t-shirt that I bought, which you can find more about at markjamesbooks.com. By the way, I do need to thank Mark James. Mark James, who we've had on the show, you know, the quintessential Memphis historian, has written so many books about Memphis wrestling and about Memphis wrestlers, and he was really integral in putting together this interview with Lance Russell. So if you're interested in more things about Memphis, go to markjamesbooks.com and check out his library. You can't go wrong with anything there. He's a great writer. He's a great historian. And also you can tell that he's got a lot of love for what he does. He's not just doing it just to do it or just to get over or whatever. He has a true passion and knowledge for wrestling and for Memphis. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have connected with Lance Russell and Shane Russell, his son. We'll talk to Shane also in this interview, and you can find out what it's like growing up to be the son of a Memphis wrestling legend. And so we'll do that just in a little bit, and it's pretty fun. So hang on for that. But I want to share some of the memories of Cauliflower Alley. So, you know, Cauliflower Alley, I don't know if you know this or not, but I mean, there's been sort of a changing of the guard as the older generation, you know, from people like Red Bastien and such pass on, that it's been passed down to Brian Blair. And I didn't, you know, I was under the impression, someone gave me the false impression that he's just kind of a figurehead. And I don't know who said that, but let me tell you, from what I saw, they are completely wrong. I barely got to connect with Brian Blair because he was running around organizing stuff and dealing with things. And let me tell you, you know, Morgan Dollar, who's also part of the Cauliflower Alley Club, he did an amazing job. It was so well organized this year as far as the content, the seminars, the people that were there. It was just first-class operation, just a a great, great job. And I think kudos to Brian Blair for the new energy and the new ideas and moving the club forward. I mean, it's always going to be nostalgia. It's always going to be the ring of friendship, and that's what you want. Talking about the past, bathed in a golden light, and that's never going to change. But I just thought that it was a new dynamic that still fit with the tone of the Cauliflower Alley Club, but it was just great. And there's so many different generations. I mean, from Trish Stratus being there and on down to Pepper Martin. Pepper Martin was there, and you may not know the name Pepper Martin, but we'll probably get him on the show. He's a wrestler from the 60s, and then he was also an actor. And I bought his book, and I'll read his book, and we'll have him on the show and talk some stories. He's primarily a California wrestling legend, but also wrestled in the Pacific Northwest. And again, he looks great. I talked to him for a few minutes, and again, I've worked on a whole bunch of interviews that we'll have on the show. I talked to Diana Hart, and I talked to the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, and so many other names that I have that are escaping me right now, but we should have some really, really fun stuff coming up in the very near future as far as tying back into Cauliflower Alley. It was really invaluable from that perspective. And we'll hopefully get some fun interviews and tell some fun stories of days gone by and your childhood memories, my childhood memories, and even some memories that predate our childhood. Because those crazy stories. And I've talked about this a little bit where, you know, it occurred to me, really hit home when I saw the WWE Hall of Fame and Stan Hansen was talking and he was listing all of those names from the past and the death of Blackjack Mulligan last week where, you know, we're losing the outlaws, that outlaw generation. And you know, it's a corporate world now. And there's nothing right or wrong about that. That's just the way it is. Everyone tries to be very corporate and very professional and try not to stir the boat because, well, quite frankly, it costs you money if you stir the pot too much. But, you know, I want to talk about that generation that stirred the pot, the stories like Brian Blair told of Tony Atlas and Paul Orndorff, and Paul Orndorff biting off Tony Atlas's ear, and crazy stories like Ken Patera told at the Cauliflower Alley banquet. We'll get into that. Ken Patera went, he was Ken Patera. And he was hilarious. So we'll talk about that. But I had to miss, unfortunately, the Bologna Blowout because I had some friends in Vegas that I needed to go see. And unfortunately, the only time I could see them was during that. So I did miss the presentation to the High Flyers and the posthumous award to Red Bastine and Charlie Smith, the referee. And I did miss those things. But I saw so many other things. One of the funnier moments was there was a seminar with Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel and also with Larry Hennig, Larry the Axe Hennig, Kurt Hennig's dad, Mr. Perfect's dad, and the grandfather of Curtis Axel, Joe Hennig. So we're in this this banquet room. There's probably about 100 people there listening to the history of Minnesota wrestling. And it's, you know, a lot of these titles, you know, I think people mean well that they're going to start out talking about it, but eventually they all break down into a Q&A, and you just kind of go different directions. And I will say this, one of the things, like, if you're going to a Q&A, seriously, unless you're somebody, if you're a fan, just like me, you're just a fan, and I'm nobody, don't get me wrong. If you're just a fan, just ask your freaking question. Nobody cares about your history. Nobody cares about who, quote-unquote, broke you into the business. Nobody cares about any story that tries to get you over or the time that you saw that guy or met him or nobody cares. Nobody cares. Just ask your question respectfully and move on. I don't care about your life story. I want to hear about everybody else, not you. So annoying. But anyway, that's enough about that. Everything else is great. So we're at the seminar with Minnesota wrestling history with the High Flyers and Larry Hennig. And suddenly, you know, just like it's so annoying when this happens at movie theaters or anywhere else, someone's cell phone starts ringing. And it's ringing. And you're looking around going, okay, it's rang like five times. Why why isn't anyone turning off their phone? And everyone's checking their phone, and everyone's looking at their phone. And suddenly it occurs to everyone that the person whose phone is ringing is Larry Hennig. 80-year-old Larry Hennig is up on the stage, and it's his phone that is ringing. And, you know, obviously he's 80 years old, so his hearing isn't what it used to be. And it finally occurs to him, he's the last person that it occurs to that their phone is ringing. And I think Greg Gagne said, hey, your phone. So Larry reaches into his pocket, pulls out his phone, and because he's 80, God bless him, there's nothing wrong with this, it's one of those little flip phones. It's a flip phone from like 2005 or something. And he looks at it, and he opens it up, and he looks at it again, and then he shuts it and puts it back in his pocket. Now, 2 minutes later, his phone rings again. And he reaches into his pocket, pulls it out, looks at it. I think he hands it to Greg Gagne and jokes, it's for you. So he hangs up on the phone again, starts talking, continues his story. And the phone rings, you got it, again. And it happens like a few more times. So finally he answers the phone, puts it up to his ear and goes, hello? And he goes, hey, hold on, it's my grandson Joe who's with WWE. That's right. Larry Hennig's in a wrestling seminar, and it's Curtis Axel calling him on the phone. And I got a picture of that. You can find it on my Twitter, at Jim Valley, of Larry Hennig looking at his phone with Joe Hennig, Curtis Axel, on the other line. And I tweeted the picture out, and Curtis Axel tweeted me out, too. So it was legitimately Curtis Axel calling his grandfather at the Cauliflower Alley Club, which was pretty funny. So that was very entertaining. I also saw another seminar, Bill Apter from the Apter Mags. He did a seminar, and for some reason he decided to put Sam Houston. Remember Sam Houston, the brother of Jake the Snake Roberts and Rockin' Robin, son of Grizzly Smith, 80s guy, 80s underneath guy for Crockett? He was there, and for some reason, Bill Apter decided to put Sam Houston. They did a figure four leg lock spot. Took a picture of that. That's tweeted out there if you want to see Bill Apter putting the figure four leg lock on 80s wrestler Sam Houston. Sam Houston looks like Waylon Jennings now. But he was a very nice guy, you know, very affable and talked to the fans and stuff. And that's the thing about Cauliflower Alley is you never know who's going to be there. It surprises you. You never know who's going to show up. Diana Hart was there. And, you know, I have the, you know, in the mid-2000s, early 2000s, Diana Hart wrote a book that was very controversial, and they pulled from the shelves, and I thought about bringing it and the off chance she was going to be there, but I figured, nah, she's not going to be there. And sure enough, she was there. It's like, oh, I wish I would have brought that book to have her autograph that controversial book, but alas. And that's just the fun stuff that happens at Cauliflower Alley. Everybody's in a good mood. You know, everybody's happy, and everyone's just talking wrestling and stories and smiling and memories and things. And it's, like I said, it's much more chill than, say, if you go to WrestleCon. I haven't been there, but it's even more chill than the Charlotte Fan Fest, in the sense that, there's some merch there to buy. There's cool things. There's people with pictures and DVDs and books and things like that, but it's just a little bit more relaxed and a little more old school. It's very, very old school, you know, and everyone wants kayfabe to come back and all that fun stuff, but it is what it is. But hey, let's grab a couple of phone calls before we go to Lance Russell here in just a second. Let's pick up 704, you're on the live cast of Jim Valley. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Brian from Charlotte, North Carolina. How you doing?
Good, Brian. What's going on, my friend?
Not a lot. Hey, the picture you posted on Twitter got me to thinking about masked wrestlers. And it used to be in the territory days that the masked wrestlers, you had the Superstar, the Destroyers, the Assassins, Mr. Wrestling 1, Mr. Wrestling 2. They seem to be a more significant part of the wrestling landscape, especially in America. And it's kind of different from the landscape in Mexico. So I was just curious, what was the purpose of the mask in the earlier days, and why has that kind of gone by the wayside other than really the Lucha Dragons in current times?
I think it comes down to one thing. It comes down to Vince McMahon. And Vince McMahon is under his philosophy is that professional wrestling is all in the face and your reactions. You know, if you watch Vince, particularly when he's in the ring, he's got these great facial expressions, the big eyes or the grimacing mouth, and he does the slow pause where he looks around and lets everyone see it. And he's great at that. But he believes that the emotion is best expressed in the in the face. So he has never been a big proponent of masked wrestlers or too many masked wrestlers. And we've seen that, Rey Mysterio was the exception because Rey is so good at, expressing things through his body and being an underdog and his body language. But, for example, when Ultimo Dragon came into the WWE, he did not do very well because he didn't, his style is different and more athletically based as opposed to Rey's style, which, has more drama and more fighting from underneath. And he's more of that underdog. So that's one of the reasons that Ultimo Dragon, for example, did not do very well as many people might have expected him to do in WWE. But yeah, you're right. Masked wrestlers, not a lot of them anymore. I got to see, I think you saw my mask. Yeah, wearing the Intelligent Sensational Destroyer mask. He's, in his 80s now. And what a great way to meet him. I mean, that guy was such a legend in Japan. Fighting Ricky Dozan and, coming in, after, all the politics, the real life politics of World War II and, giving Japan back their Japan was morally defeated, not just physically, but morally defeated after World War II and giving back some of their national pride at that point. And I'm not saying that Japan wasn't the bad guys. They were the bad guys. Don't misunderstand me, but, he was such a critical part of Japanese culture that he eventually became one of the few American gaijin in that era to become, a good guy eventually. And he's a major, major star. And he's just sitting there. He's playing cribbage. I think I tweeted out a picture of Pat LaPrade, the author Pat LaPrade, playing cribbage with the Destroyer. And he's got books for sale, and he'll talk to you. And he's really still amazingly sharp. I mean, I'm not going to live that long, and he's, 80-something and doing great. You can buy, obviously, masks and T-shirts and things, and he's just really great. You can see the old-timers. They're just sitting there playing cribbage, and it's a throwback to a time when, before all the WWE stars played video games, that back then they played cards, and it's cool to see. It's, if you ever get the opportunity, I assume you've gone to the Charlotte Fan Fest?
Yes, I've been to the Charlotte Fan Fest several times.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but maybe even more relaxed, if you can imagine that.
Yeah, I bet that would be awesome. Yeah, it just got me to thinking about Superstar and the Assassins and Mr. Wrestling too, and why they had masks their entire career, pretty much. I know Bill Eadie unmasked when he moved to WWE, but Wrestling too kept his mask pretty much his entire career, as far as I can remember.
Well, he didn't start out in the mask, but toward the end, yes, absolutely. The other thing is that, the mask used to be a way to, if you had like a guy who was a really good, hand in the ring, but maybe didn't have the best looking face or the most attractive face or was a little bland, that you could cover that up and give them some color by making them a mask character. And of course, the other thing is with Memphis, you could just rotate guys where, like for example, Dirty Rhodes would then come back under the mask as, one of the interns or whatever, and you could recycle talent that way.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Speaking of masks, I interviewed Dave Sierra, the Cuban assassin who wrestled as a mask in the Northwest for a lot of his career, and I didn't know this. He told a story about how Don Owen was the one who decided that he was going to wear a mask, and if we get a chance to play that today or next week, We'll have a story about at least one masked man for you.
Sounds great. Well, I appreciate your time, and I hope you have a good weekend.
Love the show, man. Give my love to everybody in Charlotte.
Absolutely. Take care.
Appreciate it. Love you calling in. Thank you. When they say I love the show, I don't know. I'm crazy like that. So want to talk about they do the the banquet. It all builds up to the banquet. You know, so you get there on, you know, Monday night they have a show, Sunday night they have a wrestling show. And not only that, but they, you know, so they have two wrestling shows, and those are I don't know. They're fine. I mean, the show is not meant to be a, you know, it's hard to have cohesion. How about that? When you have all of, you know, when you have 50 guys who have come in to be a part of Cauliflower Alley and they just want to wrestle on the show just for fun and for the love of the business and things. So, you know, rather than a regular show, you know, like an actual paid show where you get paid to work and the promoter's trying to make money and things, where you limit roles and you give people defined roles and people are more boxed in and what they can do. It's, you know, it's more of a free form show. And that means that it's not as focused as other shows. And that's fine. But, you know, I went to the show on Monday night, and Monday night, they had like this big 37-man battle royal. And there were also, you know, like, I don't, there literally must have been like 15 managers outside of the ring. And it, you know, it's fine. I mean, there are people who are obviously more serious about wrestling than others, who obviously invest in their gear and invest time in the gym and invest time in their craft. And there are others, quite frankly, who don't. You know, Sam Houston was in that battle royal. Johnny Devine was in the battle royal. And Paul Lee, the Nature Boy Paul Lee from the Carolinas, he actually came out to the Cauliflower Alley Club. I was surprised to see him there. Maybe we should get him on the show sometime and just talk some stories. But, you know, I mean, the battle royal was what it was. And then there was also from Japan, Io Shirai was there. And she's dynamic. And, you know, she tweeted out one of my pictures, which was awesome. And, you know, that got a couple thousand people to look at it, which was cool. And they, you know, they put on probably the match of the night. I had to come back and watch Raw because I was on the live cast, so I missed the NWA world title defense, unfortunately. But I'm sure that was good. I'm sure that was quality. But it all builds up to the banquet, to the evening banquet, which is Wednesday night. And it fills up the room. It appeared to be sold out. And there's so many different people there. I mean, I can't count the number of people that I, you know, geez, you know, Adam Ivea, Adam Johnson was there. Adam Ivea, Rocky Johnson's ex-wife, and Peter Maivia's daughter, and obviously the mother of the Rock. And, you know, Howard Finkel was there, and Terry Funk, and Reggie Parks, Dave Milliken, the belt maker, and Paul Orndorff, and Gene Okerlund, Arn Anderson, J.J. Dillon, Jim Ross. I also, one of the surprises for me was Barbara Goodish was there, the widow of Bruiser Brody. I mentioned Bill Apter, Dave Meltzer came out, Ken Patera, I'm looking through all of my Twitter pictures, JBL was there, Mick Karsh, Wade Keller's good friend and historian from Minnesota. I mentioned Mean Gene, just so many people that you're just blown away by the number of people. Pat Patterson, Sergeant Slaughter, Mil Máscaras, just a, you know, so many people. It's just crazy. You know, you're just walking by, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so-and-so, and I remember this, and it's pretty fun. But so it builds up to the banquet. And the banquet, they told people ahead of time, hey, be respectful. We want everyone to get a chance to talk and everything. So try to keep it to about, you know, 13, 15 minutes if you're an award winner. And I don't know about you, but I knew that was not going to go well. And I knew exactly when it wasn't going to go well. So it opened up with James Beard, referee James Beard got an award, and JBL inducted James Beard with the referee award. And JBL is so articulate. You know, he even mentioned that don't watch the network for Bobby Heenan and Jesse Ventura, because then you'll see that he sucks as a color commentator. But if he just stands alone, that he thinks he does fine, as long as you don't compare him to the legends. And that may be a little harsh, but I don't know. He kind of compared himself. He goes, yeah, you can see that I'm still better than Byron Saxton. And I don't know if that was a rib or just meant to be a slight, just a joke around, or if he was, you know, trying to acknowledge that he kind of knows what's up as far as WWE and people's observations and complaints. I don't know. But he was very, very eloquent and very well-spoken, and you can see why, you know, he is who he is and why he's on Fox News and other things like that. He was very eloquent talking about James Beard being the best referee he'd ever worked with. It was very nice, a very appropriate introduction by JBL, and James Beard came up and he was very gracious and talked about the role of referees and his love of the business, and that was very appropriate, I thought. Sue Atchison from the WWE, who does a lot of things with Make-A-Wish and a lot of things dealing with fans and fan engagement. She got an award, and Ricky Steamboat was there. And he introduced her and talked about her dedication behind the scenes. And, you know, Ricky Steamboat. He's an okay talker, but he's not like the most dynamic. But he was very, very sincere, and that I thought worked perfectly for the night. And Sue talked about all the work that the WWE superstars do and all the Make-A-Wishes that they do and how many more they actually do than are listed on various websites and things. And that was nice. And she talked about how, you know, she used the line, the smiles on the faces. And she must be a big Disney fan, because toward the end she talked about making magic, which is what Disney does, and that's what she likes to do. And she put a pair of Mickey Mouse ears on her head and kind of laughed about it, and that was the end of her speech. So that was cool, because I'm a big Disney fan and I love all the work that Disney does, and that was pretty great. So one of the men's wrestling awards was Ken Patera. And talk about outlaws. Ken Patera is a character's character in wrestling. And if you've ever been around Ken Patera, you know that he likes to drink. And the first thing he said when he got up there is he basically said that he had been drinking all day and he was not feeling any pain. He didn't say that, but you understand what I'm saying. And so Patera was a little unfocused, and he went on for about a half an hour or so, and people got a little bit frustrated, but it never really drug, because he'd come back with something outrageous and something hilarious. And so, while it was disjointed and lacked focus, I thought it was hilarious. And it's Ken Patera, so what are you going to do? And one of the things that I'd forgotten about, and maybe you remember from the movie dealing with the Munich Olympics in 1972, the movie Munich, where it talks about, you know, the snipers, the terrorists who took the Israeli athletes hostage. And Ken Patera, I knew he was at those Olympics, but I didn't know that he said the view from his barracks, his room, was right across the way, and he saw all of it unfold in person. And that's just, I mean, that's a witness to history. That would be, I don't know what that's comparable to, but I thought that was amazing to hear. You know, and he talked about various people and just, you know, some off-color things. And that seems to be the formula for most every Hall of Fame now. I mean, every year pretty much in the WWE, you can count on, you know, one person going off the rails, one person going crazy, and this night that person was Ken Patera. But it was not terrible. I mean, it was long, but again, he kept things moving to a degree, and they tried to get the hook, but he kept going and talking and making jokes, and it was funny, I will say that. At least it wasn't what they wanted, I'm sure, but at least it was entertaining, and Patera deserves it. And he was, you know, holding court all week and talking and everything. One of the sweetest things that happened was Paul Orndorff, another men's wrestling award winner. He was introduced by his son, and his son obviously loves his dad so much. And he talked about all the life lessons that his dad taught him and some of the crazy stories. And you can just tell that Paul Orndorff is a very traditional guy who believes in family and they have a very close bond, and it was very, very sweet to see that side. I mean, Paul Orndorff, known, obviously, is a very tough guy. You know, he even talked about, the son even talked about the fight with Vader, the famous fight with Vader, and Orndorff has a reputation for being a no-nonsense guy, but he's also very emotional, and after this really touching tribute by his son, saying how much he loved him, and how much, you know, his dad was his hero, and talking about various stories in his career that, you know, Paul came up and tried to talk, and he turned around, and, you know, he's like, oh, I'm an emotional guy, and he had to, like, walk, take a couple of steps back and turn his back to the crowd because he was crying. And he gave his son a hug again, and Mean Gene, who was the host, kind of comforted Paul, but it was really sweet. It's always great whenever you see, you know, any parent, a mother, a father, whomever, have such a close relationship with their child. It was really touching, and I'm sure it meant a lot for the son to be able to induct his dad. And it was really, really appropriate, and it was great. One thing that was funny is the son goes, "Hey, there's one thing that I want to do," and he got the famous Paula chant going. The crowd started chanting Paula, just like in the old days. And Orndorff stood up and, you know, gave the, I don't know, that thing with the elbow where you do that. It's sort of like flipping the bird, but not flipping the bird. That was pretty funny. So Orndorff obviously very, very touched, and it was a really sweet moment. And I think it meant a lot to Paul, considering all he's been through. And I'd love to get Orndorff on. Maybe I can talk to Brian Blair and we can have Paul Orndorff on. And I mean, so many stories and so many things. That guy is a legend, as far as he is one of Hulk Hogan's biggest drawing opponents. And I don't think people realize that, what a big, big star. I think he's not forgotten, but I think he should be held in higher esteem than he is for all of that he's accomplished and all of the money that he drew. Jerry Lawler inducted Lance Russell. And, of course, Jerry Lawler talked about the story where Jerry was working at a radio station and drew some pictures of the Memphis wrestlers. And Lance Russell showed them on camera, and that opened up the door to Jerry becoming a wrestler in the career that we know today. But, yeah, if it wasn't for those drawings and Lance Russell, we wouldn't have Jerry Lawler. And coming up here in just a couple of minutes, we'll play the interview with Lance Russell, and he talks about how great Jerry Lawler was and all that Jerry brought to the table during his active wrestling career. And Lance Russell came up and talked about all the stories and changes in broadcasting, all of those things. And again, if you want to see some pictures of this, you can go on my Twitter, at Jim Valley. I've got pictures of the event that night and all of the speakers, except I didn't get a good picture of Sue Atchison. It was very dark in the room. And unless you've got like a super awesome camera, it was really hard to capture. But I was able to get good pictures of pretty much everybody except for Paul Orndorff's son and Sue Atchison. But I've got pictures of everybody else, some good pictures. And I wish I would have got great pictures of everybody, but that's just the way it goes. Arn Anderson, inducted by J.J. Dillon. And again, very emotional. J.J. was crying. Arn Anderson was brought to tears. Everybody was brought to tears talking about Arn Anderson. And one of the things that I didn't know that J.J. Dillon talked about was that, as you know, Arn Anderson retired because of his hand. He lost use of his hand, a great deal of use in his hand, and a great deal of feeling in his hand due to nerve damage. And what J.J. Dillon said, which I didn't know, was that Arn Anderson kept putting off going to the doctor. And eventually, by the time, you know, he tried to work through the injury, he knew about the injury, he knew about the problem, but by the time he got to the doctor and decided to do it, get something done, that it was too late. And they operated, but there was nothing they could do, and, you know, it was entirely possible. They implied that had Arn gone to the doctor sooner, that they would have been able to save an arm. And think about that. I mean, Arn Anderson's career could have gone a lot longer. Isn't that something? It's crazy. It was very sad to hear, though. I was very, very sad to hear that, you know, that it didn't have to be that way. So Arn gave an emotional speech talking about wrestling and everything. Oh, and I forgot. Let me go back to Paul Orndorff real quick. Orndorff talked about how wrestling obviously isn't as good as it used to be. And wrestling, you know, is different and they'll never be as good as it was. And I don't know, I thought that was a little unfair. But, you know, it's not unusual to have people feel that way. Arn Anderson talked about how great the WWE is and the young superstars and all the things that he's been able to do. And he obviously thanked J.J. Dillon and Flair and everyone. And it was very, very touching. You could tell it meant a lot to Arn Anderson. And then I'm getting choked up just thinking about all this. And then the big award, the Mike Mazurki Award, the founder of the Cauliflower Alley, Iron Mike Mazurki, Trish Stratus. And I didn't see her all week, so maybe she just flew in for the award. I don't know. But I didn't get a picture with her. She was super popular, and they kind of, you know, after a while, she kind of left, and that was fine. But, you know, she was Ron Hutchison, her trainer, and the man she called her father in wrestling, introduced her, and he was obviously very proud of her and talked about her background. And then Trish came up and spoke, and she's so eloquent. She's such a good speaker and has such poise and charisma. You can see why she's so successful. And I knew that she was a fan growing up, but you can really tell by this speech how much Trish loves wrestling and how much wrestling was an integral part of her life. And that's really the cool thing, is when people who love wrestling, you know, make an impact and are successful. That's always the cool thing. And you know, I think there was some criticism on Twitter when Sting retired that I mentioned that, you know, Sting, I'm sure, loves wrestling and he had an amazing career, but he was always more of a business guy. And there's nothing wrong with having a business attitude, but he was a bodybuilder in the 80s who, like a lot of people, saw the success of Hulk Hogan and was recruited to be a part of the business. And he's a credit to the business, don't get me wrong, but it's just a different situation than Trish Stratus, who talked about, you know, she might have been the only girl who played wrestling with her Barbie dolls, and that her family played wrestling, and she grew up watching all of it, and then she got involved, and how much it meant to her, and she was just so eloquent with everything, and just, you know, just such poise, and you can see why she's successful. And there's been criticism of Trish, you know, most notably probably Bob Holly's book, talking about how she, in his opinion, she was kind of propped up, but you know, talking, you know, listening to her talk and the story she told, she loves wrestling and she's a fan and she's a credit to the business. And now that I've seen kind of her in person, I don't know how fair those criticisms were of Bob Holly saying, because I mean, it's not like she was just a model who fell into wrestling. She was a big fan. So that's cool. And she even talked about her husband, Ron, and how he was booed at the WWE Hall of Fame. And then, of course, the crowd just being funny gave him some boos, too, but not very long, just kind of a callback to that moment. That was pretty funny. But she was very emotional and thanked everyone. And, you know, it's always cool, like I said, when people who grew up watching wrestling get in the business and take that love with them as they move forward in life and move forward in the business. A great Cauliflower Alley. I encourage you to go. Like I said, it's very affordable. If you get the opportunity, it's different from the other convention style wrestling events. And I just had a great time. But the highlight for me, without a shadow of a doubt, was getting to meet Lance Russell and getting to do an interview with him, which I'm going to play for you right now. Lance Russell, the voice of Memphis wrestling, a broadcasting legend. We talked on this show about how there's a parallel between broadcasting technologies and professional wrestling from when television went national in the 50s. Wrestling was huge then. And you had big stars like Hans Schmidt and Gorgeous George and Lou Thesz and Vern Gagne. And then with the boom of cable and Georgia Championship Wrestling and the USA Network and things like that, and now with over-the-top streaming and the WWE Network, and this week in Seattle, a bunch of longtime people who have been on for a long, long time on one of the heritage stations in town, King 5, they bought out the retirements of like four or five people. And it's just an example of, you know, back in the day, you know, local programming, you had not just news, but you had, you know, maybe a midday movie with a host, and you had a local children's program with a host, and you had a local talk show, and all these local programs, and they weren't just celebrities, but you felt like you knew these people, and they were warm, and they felt like your friends. And now, everyone wants to get to the network, and, you know, now, you know, some a market like Seattle or wherever you live is just a stopping point. And rather than actually knowing these people, it just feels like they're cast, you know. Okay, you've got the older guy, you've got the wacky person, whether they're the sports person or the wacky feature person, you've got the young girl, you've got some sort of ethnic woman, and you've got, you know, it's just cast. It just feels like everyone has this same formula as opposed to something that's unique for the area. And that's unfortunate.
Hey, Livecast listeners, James Caldwell here letting you know about Loot Crate at lootcrate.com. It's like a friend, knows your preferences, knows what you like, especially in the area of merchandise, themes, t-shirts, lots of great options with a Loot Crate service. What they do is every month they send you a box, you get it in the mail, you get about $40 plus value in every crate every month, sometimes a couple of special surprises or more. If you've seen Torch Columnist Sean Radican's monthly unboxings, and go check them out on YouTube or here on our website, pwtorch.com. You know what's inside a box they send you in the mail. You get a t-shirt, you get a keychain, you get a tag, you get a photo, lots of different things from the wrestling world. Loot Crate customizes each box based on your preferences, and they also have different themes. It might be a Star Wars theme, Marvel. Lots of different themes they come up with at LootCrate.com. So if you've seen Sean Radican's unboxings, you know what you kind of expect. But Loot Crate is more than just a subscription service. It's also a community, and they share their experiences unboxing each month's crate, and you get that $40 value in the mail with your subscription service. And here at PW Torch, on the PW Torch Livecast, we have an offer where you get a discount off your crate. All you have to do is go to LootCrate.com, and when you sign up, and you set up your subscription service, enter the code PWTORCH. You get $3 off any new subscription for you. Share it with a friend. Tell a friend. Go to lootcrate.com. Enter PWTORCH as your code. Get $3 off your subscription. That's for any new subscription. So be sure to sign up quickly. There's a deadline every single month. But with that subscription, you get about $40 worth of value in each month's themed curated crate that you get sent right there in the mail with some cool stuff and with different themes each month. So again, lootcrate.com, enter the code PWTORCH, let your friends know about it, and enjoy the subscription service.
If you're like me, you've got a list of favorite websites and a list of favorite podcasts that you visit either every day or throughout the week, but there's probably not a lot of crossover between the two. However, with PW Torch Livecast, that's different. If you're a listener of this show, you should also be visiting our main website, pwtorch.com, loaded with updates covering news in more depth than you'll find anywhere else, editorials you won't find anywhere else, live TV coverage and pay-per-view coverage that's unmatched, and so much more on a newly redesigned, optimized, lightning-fast website. That's pwtorch.com. Check it out every day and bookmark it. No matter what device you're using, whether it's a mobile phone, a tablet, a laptop, or a desktop, there's a version that fits your screen and customized for your device. Check it out, pwtorch.com, one of the top sources of pro wrestling insider news since 1987 and online as a website since 1999. Don't miss out. Don't just listen to the live cast. In between live cast listens or while you're listening to the live cast, check out the latest headlines and exclusive articles at pwtorch.com.
So Lance Russell goes back to a time when more local programming was popular and prevalent. We talk about his career in Memphis and Jerry Lawler, and he even gets into some problems that he had with Jerry Jarrett, which I didn't know still existed to this day. So without further ado, here's my interview with Memphis wrestling legend Lance Russell.
How did you get into broadcasting? How did it start for you, the beginning of your career?
That was way back in Dayton, Ohio. And I started out, I was in school, high school at the time, and got interested in sports broadcasting. And I mean, that in my mind is what I wanted to do. And I went to work for WING, a radio station in Dayton, Ohio, and I went down, got a job, and they had me around there picking up papers and that kind of stuff. And that's the way I started. And then I moved on to, not up, but on, to Jackson, Tennessee, which was a smaller but a much friendlier place. So.
Now, growing up, did you have any broadcast idols that you emulated?
Bill Stern, I didn't emulate, but he was an idol. I thought he was the greatest sounding thing I'd ever heard on there. I don't know whether you ever listened to Bill Stern. I don't think he would have been around. You're too young.
I know, it's funny.
I bet you've heard that from guys like me before.
Well, and now I say it to people. You know, I have friends who are like, you know, oh, geez, kids these days, they don't know who, say, David Bowie is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know, my generation doesn't know, say, Arthur Godfrey or, you know, whomever.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And, you know, he was a giant. So, you know.
Yes, he was.
It's just the way kind of life goes.
Nasty one from everything that I ever read about him, but that's all I have to judge it.
Which is funny, because for those who don't know, Arthur Godfrey was like sort of like America's, you know, dad for a while.
That's right.
He was very personable, very nice, and, you know, maybe sort of, I don't know who would be, you know, like a Ward Cleaver kind of a thing, or, you know, like an Alan Thicke. He was, you know, kind of America's dad for a time in that era. So when did you get to Memphis?
Wow. You know, that's a question I have never been asked before.
Yes!
Good for you, Jim.
1958, Shane. Still, your son Shane is telling me 1958.
Okay, 58.
Yes. One question you've never been asked. Awesome. So I guess what I want to get at is one of the things that on my show that I talk about is how broadcasting and wrestling have sort of paralleled each other. When television exploded in the 50s nationally, wrestling was there, and then when it went back locally, and I think that's where you tie in, where, you know, TV stations, you'd have all local programming. You'd have the local talk show, you'd have the local host for movies, and maybe a local game show, and you had, you know, it was the local television station was tied into the community, and you were local. You were more than just local celebrities. People also felt like they knew you.
Yes.
Talk.
That's true.
Yeah. Talk about that and the different. Did you different jobs as far as shows you hosted and things, right?
Yes, that's true too. And it was a situation where it became necessary in my mind to get myself into that mode. The fact that people see you and they speak to you, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know you. It's because they have seen you on. And I was always aware of what a power that was, and used to, and I was selling in my earlier days too, that as you... That was one of the great things about television, is that you could make an owner of a business a personal friend of the guy sitting out there watching it, if you said the right things and did the right thing. It's a very important thing.
Well, and your warm personal style also probably drew people in and made people feel like they knew you, and I think it added to your persona and your credibility, which we'll get into. Talk about some of the shows that you hosted, that some of the programs that you did prior to being associated with Championship Wrestling.
Wow, I wish I could remember the name of that. It was in a little town in Piqua, Ohio, and it was in the midday. It was a telephone quiz show. I mean, an opportunity to call people up and ask them questions, literally. And any question that was a question of the day. And you would just call numbers and get to talk to people about there. And the whole playoff was to play off of their answers to them, and maybe it would lead you into something that was more intriguing or better or funnier or something. And that's what we used that for, and that was a really popular show too. So I can't remember the time. That was a long time ago.
You know, it's fascinating, all the tools that we have today and all the different online and mobile phone applications that engage with people. And, you know, I came from radio, and a lot of people now see radio as old and antiquated, but so many of the skills and so many of the things that you do in radio or with, you know, with a simple phone line and a black and white TV camera, it's all really the same.
Yeah.
Communicating is communicating, and, you know, you got to keep people engaged, and, you know, don't go too long, don't go over, you know, it's all really the same.
Yeah, I think you make a good observation right there, Jim. So, it is in some ways, is still magnificent to me what you can do with radio and contacting people and getting to know people.
So what were you doing when they first approached you about championship wrestling?
Actually, we'll just leave out the championship part of it. And I was in Jackson, Tennessee, and that was down in the land of Nick Gulas and Roy Welch. And all of that started with Roy Welch, whose nickname among the wrestlers was Bag Ears. Because he had, my son and I were talking about that just the other day, about Bag Ears and how did he go with that. I said, that was a badge of honor for him. His ears, I've never seen, and that's what Shane was making a reference to, is bad. Roy had the worst set of ears that I believe I have ever run across in wrestling or boxing or anything else. And Bag Ears is what they call him. And if it just, that describes what Roy Welch's ears were like. And so that's where I started off in wrestling, working with them. And that came when the station moved in a live wrestling show on Saturday night. The owner of the television and radio show stations that I was working for, WDXI TV and radio, they had purchased a, I can't think what you call them, they built a jillion of them after the World War II, to live in and to be school buildings and round shape.
Almost like a hangar type structure.
So there was a lot of that particular the building, and right now I've forgotten where I was at. That happens.
So that's where you set up with the wrestling. So what was your, had you been exposed at all to wrestling prior to this first indoctrination?
In Ohio is where I first, from Dayton, Ohio, and that was when I was I used to work in the auditorium there, and all of the programs that came to town, and once a month, wrestling came in. And so that's where I first started watching some pretty doggone good wrestling, I'm telling you, in Dayton, Ohio. It was very, very high class and really the most colorful and, maybe not as colorful as they're doing them today, but flying.
Lots of action.
Lots of action.
So what was, wrestling is, I love wrestling. You love wrestling. Everybody here in Las Vegas loves wrestling. But sometimes people don't have the best impression of of wrestling.
Sure. My wife used to be sensitive to that when I started doing that. And people would say, oh, you're the wrestling guy. You know, and it's, I mean, she had to get used to that. That's peculiar when your wife is suspicious of you.
Yeah, my wife doesn't go to wrestling. When she was my girlfriend, she went to wrestling. But now that she's my wife, she doesn't. I don't know why. I have no idea why that is. I just don't know. So how did you work to keep? I mean, you were a news personality. You know, you were the program director and managed the station and things. How did you did? Was it ever an issue to deal with managing your credibility? Dealing with, you know, your professional life and then also being associated with professional wrestling and some of the crazy characters and things that happen in wrestling?
I think, yes. The answer to that is yes. It was in both sides of the fence that I would have people who just resented. And why do you have that on the air? I mean, what is being gained usefully out of having that show on the air? And then you had the people who said, oh, we've been waiting, and so forth. They were so tickled and all. It was a real polar experience with wrestling.
And it was huge. When did you realize getting involved? Like, how big was it? Was it, you know, when Jackie Fargo or who, what really opened your eyes? You're going, wow, this area loves wrestling.
Well, Jackie Fargo was... Before I really started, I was not the first wrestling announcer in the town. A man that I worked with was probably the best announcer that I ever worked with. His name was Charlie Sullivan, and he worked on the NBC station. I was working on the ABC station at the time. And so I walked into... Everybody who ever said, I like wrestling, knew Charlie Sullivan. He was just, he was a home daddy to them. And Charlie probably had more influence on me changing my style. I think I was more trying for electricity and excitement and, you know, and I did high school football, and Lord knows that's very exciting for the families that have the kids that are playing it. But it was a definite change in from a more excited delivery back to just straight natural talking about it. And
As I told you, I didn't get to see you in your prime, but I saw you on YouTube now. And I was a kid when cable TV exploded in the 80s, so I was exposed to Gordon Solie and everyone. Yeah. And I actually, you know, just real quick, my background, you know, I went to the WWE in about 10 years ago and did an audition. So I have some experience in broadcasting and wrestling announcing. And now where I'm going with this is that now that I see you... on YouTube, it's like, I think that you are better than people give you credit for. I think you're the best announcer for wrestling.
That's very nice.
And you may not call all the moves, and I think too many people put too much emphasis on calling the moves, but you express the action, and more importantly, you told the story as far as you know, who these people are, what their motivations are, and also I think what's great is you talk about in very general terms that people can understand, you know, oh, there's a size difference here, or there's an experience difference here. And I think that helped the enhancement guys, mm-hmm. you know, the underneath guys, because, you know, they're not losers. They're just inexperienced guys who don't have it put together yet in their careers.
Yeah. Well, that, I guess I'm glad. Boy, you got a great eye for picking up details like that, Jim. That's interesting to hear you put it that way. And
was that intentional?
Huh?
Did you do that intentionally?
I think so. Yeah. It was something that was necessary to do in order to get across the picture of it, is to play on a guy's inexperience and what he might do, might slip into a side headlock of some kind without even be aware of it if he didn't have his head pressed in the right position where he could resist somebody slipping an arm around his head and squeezing.
Now, did you ever have to do preparation for the show, or did you and Dave Brown just knew each other well enough and you could wing it?
I had the advantage on Dave in experience, like we're talking about inexperience and other things, but and Dave was he wasn't far behind because he was a fast learner and a hard worker, and my goodness, that was an important thing as far as I was concerned, somebody that was really interested. And Dave, when he started, was not interested, except in the fact of when he came to me and I went to him to see. He was working under me as a staff announcer, and I went to Dave and said, I lost the guy that is helping me on the wrestling thing. Would you be interested in coming in with me and working as a color man on the wrestling team? And he said, well, that's not really what I had in mind. And I said, Dave, let me tell you one thing. If you do wrestling, I will tell you at the end of the year, you will have more experience of dealing with more various emotional things as the time goes along that you would ever get if you spent all of your time as a newsman or as a weatherman or something like that. And I said, if you ever planned on using television as a vehicle to make a living, my suggestion to you is that you take this job because you will learn an awful lot from it. And Dave said that was probably the best piece of advice he ever got anywhere, anytime in broadcasting. And he turned out to be, obviously, now we look back after all of the polls and all that they do about the personalities doing the news block, Dave in the Memphis area is just by and large the dominant number one personality there.
And it's something you don't really get anymore with so much diversification of media and everything is so siloed. So one thing that I was curious about with your career is at some point, did you leave the TV station and go work specifically for Jarrett Promotions?
Yes. I went to work for Jerry Jarrett. It came in a turmoil position where Jarrett Promotion, Roy Welch and Nick Goulas, I mentioned to you earlier, were the dominant forces. They did the promoting in the South. And Nick had been from Birmingham, and Roy had been from up around Arkansas and West Tennessee and all. And so when Jarrett came in, he came in as a Goulas Welch employee. And he bright, and he had a marvelous idea for picking up things that would be good broadcast flavor and get with people, and it became a competition, and he went to battle against Welch and Goulas and Welch, and he won hands down. Thank goodness for him, because he knew me. Because I was working for the station and made no bones about it. My interest is in developing money for the station. And we had a higher than average cost per thousand on spots that were sold in the wrestling thing because our audience was bigger. And so it became a flat out them, that is Goulas Welch against the Jarrett Promotion, and Jarrett won it hands down and didn't take 3 weeks, and Goulas was on another station and out of business, as a matter of fact.
I read Jerry Jarrett's book not that long ago, and mm-hmm. one of the things that I don't know, kind of struck me as odd, and if you don't want to talk about this, that's fine. Where he talks about where, you know, as history of wrestling shows, that usually the top star and the promoter eventually butt heads. And I think, you know, Jerry built that nice house, from what I understand. And Jerry Lawler was like, oh, what's going on here? And he thought about breaking away. And I guess he came to you about possibly breaking away.
Yes.
They made a deal.
Yes.
And in the book, Jerry talks about, well, I couldn't punish Jerry Lawler, so I had to punish Lance Russell. And I thought, well, I guess business is business. But I thought, you know, given a guy in your position and all the things you've done in championship wrestling, it kind of struck me as, I don't know, a little just different. Was there a rough patch there for you and Jerry in your relationship?
Jerry Jarrett. Yeah, I think you could say that.
It's water under the bridge, but I was just kind of surprised that he didn't.
I hope it's under the bridge, but I'm not sure.
I was just kind of surprised that, I don't know, the way he wrote it and everything, it just kind of struck me, I guess.
Yeah, well, it struck me, too, when I was working with him. We didn't get along at all at that time. It suddenly changed, and he started saying things about me and my trustworthiness, and that really tore me up because I'd never had anybody question my word or anything before, and it was. And so Jerry and I are not on the best of terms, to put it. And
okay, I didn't know that. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's talk about some good stuff. You know, obviously everyone knows about your work with Jerry Lawler. Like when Jimmy Hart left Memphis.
Yes.
And they did the bit where he dumped a bag of flour
on
your
head. Fact.
Did you know that was coming?
Not to that extent. Never did I have any idea. I thought he would take like a handful of flour and throw it at me. He took the whole bag and pa-pow. And I was dumb enough. If you can imagine being that old and still forgetting something that I knew that my mama said, water and flour will get you well on the way to glue. And when Jimmy hit me with that covered up bag, whole bag of flour, we had a shower, of course, back in the back there of downstairs, and I ran back and I got in the shower to get off as much of the stuff, and all I did was successfully start on making glue, Mama. And it was terrible. It was just an awful feeling. And I wanted to kill Hart right on the spot. But it turned up, it gave me a good excuse to fire him, to get rid of him. They gave him, he didn't have any place to go. Of course, tongue in cheek, because he had all this set up that he wanted to get fired. And he wanted to get away from, and so he went to
New York after
yes,
that.
Yes, he did.
Was there anybody that you thought that on Saturday morning that you had a particularly good repertoire with that was fun to play off of? Anybody?
Jerry Lawler. Yeah. Lawler was the number one player that I ever went with. In wrestling, I mean, in broadcasting. And Jerry was just exceptional in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's not fair. Oh, you're favoring him. Oh, yeah? He's lucky. I mean, the rest of the guys are lucky that some of them were and some of them weren't, because Jerry was just an exceptional individual. He just had not only the physical thing, he never has had a drink of whiskey. He's a guy who did not carouse and do all the things that wrestlers are accused of, whether they're guilty or not, by the public. And Lawler never was that way.
One of the guys who I don't know that he went too many places outside of Memphis that I really thought was. Had a lot of charisma and a lot of ability was Troy Graham, Dream Machine.
And yeah, Dream Machine.
You could pat him off and say that, you know, he was kind of a Dusty Rhodes ripoff, but really, you know, there's some similarities, but he really kind of was his own guy. He said a lot of creative things, and I think he's kind of one of those undiscovered Memphis guys.
Yeah, but you're right. You got a good eye, man. You like to act like you've been around wrestling a little while. Too.
I've wasted a lot of time.
No, it's not all wasted.
Do you want to come in? Here's your son. Your son Shane. Shane,
I got a great story about Troy Graham. I was just with Jimmy Hart last week, and we were just talking about some old wrestlers. And I said we were talking about the time when Troy jumped you.
Oh,
and he goes, "You know how Troy got in the business? He says, one morning we were looking for a wrestler to fill in because we were short on Saturday morning. He went out back, and there were usually some guys standing out back. And he went up to Troy Graham and said, hey, have you ever wrestled before? You ever been on a mic? And he said, Troy started whipping off some of his great rhymes. And he said, you're hired. Come on in.
Hey, before you go away, Shane Russell, your Lance's son, what was it like to have your dad...
And manager.
What was it like to have your dad, on TV, the kids at school, seeing things like, Jimmy Hart or, whatever happened on TV? What were some of the reactions growing up?
Well, I was always very well known in grade school, and the kids always would want to, know more about wrestling and dad and some of the wrestlers. And so I got a little bit of respect. I didn't get beat up any, so that was always good. But, thanks to Jerry Lawler, I was known as Banana Nose Jr. because I do have that trademark nose. So. It was great. I can very vividly remember as a kid going down early on Channel 13 studios and sitting up on the side and watching the early days with Don and Al Green and Tojo and Jackie Fargo and, all those guys way back. And it was just a great time.
Was there ever a time, when you were a kid, were you smart to the business or did you know?
Early on, I had no idea. I thought it was all, all legit. And then eventually, I got older and wiser. And it was an exciting time back then.
Was there ever a time when you were worried about your dad's well-being on TV?
Early on, it was because back in those days, I think some of the guys would love to try to get you or get a shot at you or tear your suit.
A little bit of a shot would do for some of them, and so fortunately that was true.
Now, my mom was the one who got real upset when the blood would get on his suit or they'd tear his suit. That was his suit, so we had to pay for it.
Glamorous wrestling. Now, let's say that you have to put something in a time capsule.
Yes, sir.
One moment from championship wrestling. What do you think is your favorite moment or the quintessential championship wrestling moment?
Well, now that may be two different things because there's some moments that were just absolutely hilarious, but I wouldn't call that a characteristic of all wrestling for sure, because we found out when I went to WCW and went down with Turner Broadcasting and got down there, I ran into, can you believe that there were people who didn't think that I was a nice, quiet Southern boy or anything like that? There were other guys from other areas that were working in there with them that I ran into, and they didn't like me because I was the guy in Memphis that did things a little different than most of the guys.
Memphis kind of had a stigma even in the wrestling world. Absolutely. which is crazy.
I thought it was, and it I was indignant about it because
as I watch Memphis wrestling now, it's like so much of what they do today, well, not exactly, and it's different, but so much of what is done today is transferred over to Memphis, where you've got to be a well-rounded performer, you've got to be able to do a little comedy, you've got to be able to wrestle, you've got to be able to be serious. So much of what I see in quote-unquote sports entertainment, I think, came from Memphis.
Yeah, well, I think that's another great observation, Jim. I think it's absolutely true. And this is the thing that I say, well, all you do is laugh. Well, when we worked in a rural area and we're doing spot shows out away from the Memphis Coliseum, which was an 11,000 seat holder, and we put 11,000 in there many times. When we went out into the rural area, we got people that were a little more earthy, if you want to use that old term. And I believe me, and I mean this, and I'm happy with it and proud of them. These people were more country, some of them. but bless it, they were good, solid people. And people that I consider friends of mine today, a lot of them. When I go to a meet and greet somewhere out and go to the Memphis area, that's where I want to go, is out in the area. And it's just amazing what a difference in some places. So we started with the premise that Jarrett says they pay just as much to laugh at what they're looking at as they do to cry or pull back in fear or something like that. And so if that's what they want to do and we're doing something that they think is funny, then great, let them chuckle. And so, you know, that's why, because in so many parts of the country at that time, Jim, they were working so hard to make certain that nobody had the word fake involved with any of it, that they didn't have their minds on reality and what would happen, and what if somebody said that to your wife? And that's the way Jerry Jarrett thought. I give him credit. I mean, let me tell you, don't mistake anything that I might have said about us having our differences in there with respect and the talent that guy had. He's the best I ever saw in that respect. And the next best right along with him was Jerry Lawler as a wrestler, and think that wasn't valuable to have a guy with that kind of imagination working in the ring. And when he pulled that strap down, then you knew he had come up with something in his mind that he was ready to execute, because he would go from there to trigger the move that set up how the result was going to be, the end result was going to be.
You guys did a lot of things on a shoestring budget without, you know, the highest priced talent in the world. I mean, that's an amazing accomplishment, that you produced so much content that, you know, generated so much revenue and generated so much interest in the community. But, you know, rather than having to bring in, you know, every major star, you know, you created a lot of stars. You know, maybe one week Dirty Rhodes would be Dirty Rhodes, and the next week he'd be under the mask as a medic or what have you. I mean, you guys did a lot of things with very little bit, and that's show business.
You're right. I mean, that's exactly it, and that's what ours was. I mean, recognize it, friend. We're not the top dollar place in the world in wrestling in there, and so we got to get along on what we got. And you hit it right on the button. I mean, they had every kind of job lined out for everybody that worked there. And that's one thing that made it great, because you had well-rounded guys. And this is why I thought that when I went down to WCW, that there were these guys that having problems with me. I had problems with them because they had never worked under conditions as varied as the condition that I had worked under.
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking down on Memphis doesn't make any sense considering when you saw some of the stuff that WCW did, but that's another story for another time.
Right.
Okay, real quick, we'll wrap it up here. Give us like one favorite championship wrestling memory that you enjoyed that warms your heart. What did you love?
Well, this one is, at the time I didn't enjoy it, because I didn't know what the outcome of it was going to be. This is when our equipment failed. That is to say, the wrestling ring broke in the middle, and the canvas went down in it, and we kept wrestling, babe. And the guys would get around the edge of that crater, and they would jump down into that hole, and you could see their arms flailing up above the level of the floor in there, because the whole canvas had caved in, and it was amazing to see those guys continue to do what they did and make a most interesting wrestling show as it was.
Lance Russell, 90 years old, still going, and an amazing career, a legend in broadcasting and in professional wrestling. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, Jim, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it, and I love your observations. You're good.
Do me a favor. Follow me on Twitter
And also retweet the interview. Let's see if we can get it out there and get me some more followers and get people interested in Saturday morning wrestling. So next week we'll do an interview with The Grappler, talking about some times in Portland, and Bill Watts. Follow me on Twitter, share it all, and I appreciate all of the engagement. Gosh, my phone was, as you could hear, it was blowing up when things were going down. So I love that you're listening. I love that you're engaged. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate it. This show is the highlight of my week. Thank you to Brian Blair. Thank you to Wade Keller. Thank you to Caldwell, James Caldwell. And we will see you next Saturday morning. Tell your friends. Wake the neighbors. Katie, bar the door. 8:30 Pacific, 11:30 Eastern, and always here at your service at pwtorchlivecast.com. I'm Jim Valley. This is Saturday Morning Wrestling, and we will see you same Saturday time, same Saturday channel. This is live.